May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. And may we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Now is the time for our centering, in the center of our service and in the center of our lives. Let us bring it down to a whisper to honor the silences of our world. Who are you? Where are you? Be here now. Be here. Please feel free to light a candle of memory and hope if you are so moved, or to light a candle for a wish upon a star. Let us seal this centering and sacred time in prayer. Spirit of life and love, we pause before you to breathe in each moment of life with grace and gratitude. Let us awaken to a deeper reality of life and make of our lives an offering. We join together in this beloved community to open our hearts to the presence and power of love. Where there is pain and loss, may we know comfort and may we learn to be compassionate. Where there is fear and concern, may we know courage, faith, and patience. And for the joy and the love in our lives and for this community, we give thanks. Let us dream together, pray together, and work together to build one world of peace and justice for all. Amen. Good morning. Thank you for coming this morning on this Labor Day weekend. I feel honored to be here in this pulpit, and I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to have this pulpit as a learning tool. And I want you to know that this is an honor that I do not take lightly. For my first sermon to you, I want to introduce myself by telling you who I am and what I've been and what brought me to ministry and to you. It's a lot of life, so you might be glad that I'm abbreviating it a little bit. So I want you to feel you can know me, so I'm going to start at the beginning. I had what could be called an idyllic childhood. I was the youngest child of four, and to this day, my father is my hero. He was handsome, funny, smart, and crazy about his kids. We had wonderful surprise adventures that remain embedded in my memories. And one of my very favorite memories is when my father would take us to Coney Island in Cincinnati, and he would purchase a string of ride tickets that were a mile long. And he'd hold them up over his head and yell, "Charge!" And we would all go racing after him to the nearest roller coaster. He loved the roller coasters more than we did. He made us feel like we were the most important things in his life. And my memories are vivid, even though he traveled a lot for work and was away from home. He had twin degrees in engineering and owned his own consulting firm. And the firm bought a small twin beach aircraft, which they used for business trips. And when there was an empty seat, my father let me ride co-pilot. My father had a plaque on his desk in his office that said, "Everybody wins." And I believe that he lived up to that. I watched him fly Red Cross supplies into Louisiana when Hurricane Camille devastated so many homes. He was always doing something to help someone out. We were taken to Christian Science Sunday School as children, but not consistently, and I think back maybe only enough to pacify my grandmother Harrington. Dad's mother was a stern and intense woman who was a devout Christian Scientist. Our religious education came more from example than formal training. My parents taught us to be fair and honest and loving and not to speak ill of others. And my father's favorite admonition to us still echoes in my mind. Remember, Kathy, the father did not make a mistake when he made that person. My mother was a stay-at-home mom through my early years, and she filled the house with the smell of fresh baked bread and homemade cookies. She also carried breakfast in bed on a tray to my father for 30 years so that he could watch the news before he went to work in bed. She'd send us off to school with lovely dresses, often homemade and sometimes matching, with stride-right shoes, lace socks, and perfectly braided hair. I rarely came home with my braids intact, and those lovely lace socks were filthy and shoved down into my shoes. But she never gave up on me, and the next day we would do it again. She read to us every night, and sometimes it was a chapter from Winnie the Pooh, my favorite. But some of the unspoken messages I got from my parents weren't so positive. Like the time my dad gave my big brother a ticket around the world for graduation. He gathered us all together to inform us of this gift, and my mother sat silently as he told us three girls that this was only a gift that they could do for a son. We weren't allowed to complain. He would always say, "Don't plague everyone else with your disabilities." And maybe that is why my mother suffered so silently all those years while my handsome father succumbed to the admiration of other women. The double standard and patriarchy and poor communication skills were explicitly and implicitly woven into our lives. When I was in the first grade, I witnessed the almost daily paddling of an African-American boy in my class. He was disruptive. He couldn't sit still. And even in my immature 6-year-old understanding, I knew that he wasn't bad. He was retarded, as they said in those days. My heart would pound and my eyes would blur with tears when the principal would come and call him into the hall where his punishment awaited. And I remember feeling extremely unsafe. He always returned wiping his tears. And I felt like I'd let him down because I did not have the courage to stand on my desk and scream, "This is wrong." He was the sweetest boy I'd ever known. And all I could do to help him was to love him and be kind to him. I'm still haunted by this memory of the injustice of a system that failed to see the dignity and the soul of a handicapped child. And then when I was around 9 years old, I remember hearing my parents whisper about a colleague's wife who gave birth to a mongoloid baby. She was older and these things happen, I heard them say. They never brought the baby home. The mother never even saw him, never held him. He was sent away because he wasn't normal. I felt so sad for that mother's empty arms and that motherless baby boy. And I wondered, would he be scared and sad? Would anyone love him? I remember like it was yesterday, the utter fear that filled my knowing that I was living in a world where babies can be discarded because they are not born meeting our expectations. And what about God? What about Daddy's promise that the Father doesn't make mistakes? When I was in junior high school, my best friend's big brother Stevie was in a car accident. They'd been drinking, and he was thrown through the windshield. He survived barely. They called him a vegetable. I visited him when they brought him home from that place on the hill where he lived with other people that society hides from. He always recognized me, and I had to muster my courage in the face of my fear and anguish. And my faith in an all-powerful God and a loving God was rapidly diminishing. My idyllic family illusion began to fall apart in my teens, and my parents' personal and financial situation grew fragile and tense. 3 kids in college at the same time added to the pressure, and I was finally an only child. We lived in a 100-year-old house with 3 stories and the second floor with 4 bedrooms that my father called kids' country, was silent and lonely. My mother worked as my father's secretary those years for no pay, and they worked late almost every single night, and those times for me were dark and depressing. So I wound up being the only child in our family not to go to college because I married my high school sweetheart at age 17. I didn't go to my high school graduation because my 7-month pregnancy was impossible to hide. And even if they would have allowed me to go, which they wouldn't, I was too filled with shame. Thank goodness my parents were wonderfully supportive. They never stopped loving me. And 12 days after my 18th birthday, when my son was born, they were proud grandparents to the max. This beautiful red-headed baby boy seemed to take center stage, and all of the other problems seemed to fade away. My mother quit working to become a full-time grandmother, and because my new husband's mother owned 4 beauty salons, it was decided that I should go to beauty school. It wasn't really my idea, and it wasn't something I was terribly proud of. Hairdressers were never portrayed as being intelligent, compassionate, moral. But the truth is that they often find themselves in the role of minister and counselor. The state of Florida has recognized the importance of the relationship of a hairdresser and client, and they are now training hairdressers to be able to counsel women who are abused and encourage them to get professional help. And that's my plug for hairdressers. I never met a hairdresser I didn't like. Well, almost. So my teenage marriage was pretty much a mess, but I did my best to tough it out. It was shameful enough to have to get married. Divorce would have been the ultimate humiliation and embarrassment for my family. But my shame lurked beneath my surface, the surface of my being. It was like I was lined on the inside with my mistakes, like a badly wallpapered bathroom. 4 years later, I had a second child on the way, and I was working part-time in one of my mother-in-law's beauty salons. I had a client who had a severely handicapped child, and when she would bring her in for a haircut, it was a disaster. She was spastic, and she violently resisted my efforts. Her mother would hold her down, and she would scream and flail as I attempted to try and cut this hair. Sometimes she would throw up. Sometimes she would wet her pants. When I was so filled with terror when I was faced with this task, and I also was thoroughly disgusted with myself for my feelings of revulsion and fear that I had for this child. And I was also in complete and utter awe of a mother, a dedicated mother, whose life was completely consumed with caring for this child. How did she do this? I had no idea. How unfair is this? Where is God? My guilt and my fear took the form of a deep-seated anxiety that I would give birth to a handicapped child, and that irrational thought never left my mind during my entire pregnancy. So after several years of enduring a miserable marriage, I mustered the courage to end it, and I became a single parent. The struggles were so immense that I sought refuge in yet another marriage that turned out to be abusive. It was not to be my last. I was left wounded and confused. I found myself fleeing to my mother's house with my little children in tow, in tears, asking her why I could not find someone like my dad. It was then that she told me the crushing truth. It's time you knew your father isn't perfect. I was heartbroken. First God, and now Dad. I felt like I was alone against the world. With 3 small children to raise, my passion evolved into a wild kind of anger that guarded my brood like a samurai warrior swinging a 2-edged tongue. unaware of myself for years. It seemed to be the only thing that kept me alive. So there are no guarantees that being born healthy, one remains healthy. And around the same time, a grieving mother formed the organization Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. And so I thought about that, and it occurred to me, so many people that meet tragedy end up doing something wonderful, creating a service that blesses mankind. So I thought, if I did the service part first, maybe I could bypass the tragedy, sort of like leaving out the middleman. So I waited and I looked for some way that I could help. The opportunity came years later when I had another client with a handicapped child. Kathy was 35 years old and spent most of her life in a loving home with siblings and caring parents. But when her father died, her mother could no longer care for her alone, and so reluctantly, she moved her to Witten Center, a state home for handicapped adults in Clinton, South Carolina. She asked me if I would go to Witten Center with her one day. They were having a Christmas party for the residents, and she wondered if I would bring my scissors and cut Kathy's hair before the party. So I said, okay. I certainly wasn't prepared for what I saw at Witten Center. The parents' club that consisted of mainly a handful of dedicated parents had sponsored the party. Most of the residents had no one who visited them. Their parents were either dead, or they lived too far away, or maybe they just didn't care. All I know is Kathy was one of the lucky ones. The range of disorders and deformities at Witten Center were tremendous. Most of the clients attending this party were over 35 years old, and many of them were in wheelchairs. A very loud, very mediocre country band was playing really loud music, and the clients who were able danced and sometimes drug me out on the dance floor with them. Santa Claus came and brought gifts for all of them, lotion for the ladies and socks for the men, and they were thrilled to get them. I saw a man with elephant's man disease, and I quickly looked away. And I noticed that many of the residents who were having the best time, who were the most outgoing, and who were the healthiest, had Down syndrome. My thoughts raced back to when I was 9 years old and that mother's empty arms and that baby that was sent away. It was pretty overwhelming for me, and my emotions were careening, but I was determined to face my fears. So I got really busy. I was serving food and drink, feeling very helpful and very righteous, all the while doing my very best to not look at them. But when I was pouring soda for a severely handicapped man in a wheelchair who precariously held out his glass to be filled with spastic fingers and deformed hands, I felt powerfully compelled to look at him. I found myself looking into the most beautiful blue eyes I've ever seen. This man was a sight. His white hair was disheveled and his face unshaven for days. His smiling mouth revealed crooked teeth with much of his meal lodged between them, and his face was covered with cake. Yet as I sank into these endless blue wells of love and peace, I was literally paralyzed. And I'm not capable of articulating to you exactly what happened to me in that moment. Except that I will tell you this, that I was convinced that I was looking into the eyes of God. And from that moment on, my life was transformed. I cried all the way home. And I didn't tell anyone about my experience for years. But I did have a deep conviction from then on that all the children that come into this world needing extra assistance are not just the responsibility of the parents. The tragedy of birth defects or illness or whatever happens to us in life that makes us dependent should not fall on the shoulders of the family. The responsibility of caring for each other should fall into the arms of humanity. They belong to all of us, and we are all valuable human beings, deserving of love and respect. I had found something to believe in that didn't require a God that could make everything perfect. My childhood Sunday school class had a plaque on the wall that said, God is love. One of the few things I remember from Sunday school. And what I've grown to believe is that God's love is a verb. God is a divine process which we are all invited to participate in. So I volunteered to give haircuts to the residents in Kathy's unit for several years, one Sunday a month. And I took my children with me every chance I got. We adopted a woman named Sylvia who was 43 at the time, older than I. And when I went to cut the residents' hair, we would take her to lunch and take her shopping. She loved toys and getting new clothes. Sylvia had a mischievous twinkle in her eye, and her sense of humor brightened the depressing institutional surroundings. She was a skilled con artist, and she found me an easy mark. Sylvia became a very important person in our lives. Late one Sunday afternoon, after a long and tiring day of haircuts, I was really looking forward to the solitude of driving home through the peaceful Carolina countryside, and they brought me one more client, and when I saw her, my heart sank. As she was led towards me, I could not even imagine, with all the talent that I could muster, that I could help this head of hair. It looked like a fright wig. And the woman resembled every conjured up witch or crone in the history of fairy tales put together. She scared me. I wasn't sure what she would do if she could sit still, and I was so tired. All I knew to do was to reach into my weary being and muster the willingness to see it differently and the courage to stay. And I reminded myself that she was as beloved and perfect to God as anyone. Much to my amazement, underneath that dry, frizzy mop of hair was hiding an absolutely gorgeous head of naturally curly hair. Some hairdresser, who I believe should be shot, had given this woman a permanent wave and fried her hair. It had grown out in the shape of a wild and monstrous Brillo pad. But as I cut away the mess, sculpting and crafting, I got more and more excited, and I could not help myself. I kept repeating to her over and over, "You are going to be so beautiful." And when I finished, she was. She was beautiful. She was transformed, and so was I. And in her shining face, I saw that same light and that same love that had made the earth stand still with that blue-eyed old man. Of course it was always there, but I had not been willing to see it. Love is a choice. So I had learned from these wonderful people to look beyond form and to choose to see the perfect love in each of them. And I believe that God's love can be found in the eyes of our brothers and sisters and only requires our willingness to see. Love is a choice. And isn't that what Jesus meant when he said, "The kingdom of God is within you"? I think back now and I realize that I heard God calling at age 6. And I finally said yes when I faced my fears at Witten Center. I'm reminded of a poem written by one of my friends and classmates at Star King called Calling. When you heard that voice and knew it finally called for you, and what it was saying, where were you? Were you in the shower wet and soapy, or chopping cabbage late for dinner? Were you planting radish seeds or searching for one lost sock? Maybe wiping handprints off a window, or coaxing words into a sentence, or coming upon a hyacinth, or one last no. Where were you when you heard that ancient voice, and did yes get born right away, and did you weep? Had it called you since before you even were? And when you knew that, did your joy escape all holding? Where were you when you heard that voice calling, and how in that moment did you mark it? However after are you changed? tell us, please, all you can about that voice. Teach us how to listen, how to hear. Teach us all you can of saying yes. And the yes I heard called me to become a minister. The yes has now brought me to be here among you for the coming year. And I know that I will learn much from you about how to be a better minister. It is a joy to be here with you. May our hearts be always willing and open to choose love. Amen.